Welcome back to How to Tickle Yourself. I'm your host, Duff McDonald, along with my co-host, Joya Rockledge.
Hello.
In every episode, we and our guests try to seek out and grab hold of the tickle of our true selves. By sharing stories about the great things in life, we hope to point the way to the goal of goals, the source of infinite bliss, the supreme reality itself. Maybe we will find it someday. In the meantime, we hope, at the very least, to inform and entertain with conversations that hover at ratings approaching 100%. At How to Tickle Yourself, we always play through the pain. All of which brings me to today's guest, Margot Steines, the author of the recently released and captivatingly titled memoir, Brutalities, A Love Story. We'll get back to the book in a moment. But let's tell you about Margot first. A professor, creative coach, and editor on the faculty of the University of Arizona Writing Program, Margot teaches small group creative nonfiction writing classes and seminars. As she describes them, they're the classes she wishes she had found when she was a fledgling writer. Warm, generative, and trauma-informed, with a value placed on process before product. So she's helping people find their voice. We are very much in favor of that here at How to Tickle Yourself. Trauma, as it turns out, is a central theme in Brutalities, her memoir of a couple of decades spent in parts of the world and of life that most of us have only heard or read about. S&M parlors, mental institutions, hospital detox wards, antidepressants, and a couple of suicide attempts thrown in for good measure. It might seem a little counterintuitive to have the memoir of a professional dominatrix be the subject of How to Tickle Yourself, especially a memoir that explores in graphic detail what it's like to both give and receive the most extreme kinds of physical pain imaginable. Can pain tickle? We will discuss. But it's not counterintuitive at all. First of all, we love writers here at How to Tickle Yourself. We also love memoirists, having become one ourselves. But what we love most of all is people who can talk about what it's like to seek out and experience real change, the kind of change that allows you to become reacquainted with the essence of your own existence. That's the through line of the story in Brutalities, the string the pearls are strung on. And it emerges like a phoenix out of all the self-hate and the violence. To top it all off, Margot is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful writer. And the words on her pages crackle with both fathomless insights and a wicked way with words, the best combination of all. The reviewers agree too. She recently got her hands around the brass ring of writer's prizes, a glowing review in the New York Times book review section entitled Pain Was Her Drug. Check that out and check out the book. But welcome to the show, Margot. We are so happy to have you.
Thank you so much. That was like that felt so good. Thank you.
The present moment, traveling town to town, the mystery of the motion, right here, right now, right here, right now, whoa, right here, right now.
You know, when Duff first talked about your book, I was like, I had this sort of internal, like, I was a little scared of it. I was like a little scared to read it. And it's amazing. And it's so accessible. And your writing is so good. And I think there were so many parts of it. I related to it all the way through. Like, I've never had a baby. And like, you touch on your pregnancy and kind of use that sort of as a filter. But there's so much of it that's relatable. I think any woman anywhere is going to find bits and pieces of herself in your book. Like, nice work. It's really beautiful. And it's not scary. So anyone who's thinking that they might not want to read it because it's scary, it's not. It's really beautiful and sweet and heart-wrenching. And yeah, no, I loved it. all the way through.
Is there a question in there, Joey? You got a
there's
question?
There's not really. I just wanted to get that part out of the way and let her know right off the bat.
You've been working on this book for a while, Margo. Better part of a decade, right? Or more.
Yeah. Working on a previous project that I ended up bailing on that was sort of like the seeds of this project. And I grew a lot as a writer in between then and now. But I had started the work back then and circled back to it, you know, in different form with new skills and, you know, also having had some significant other life experiences. And I think most importantly, like the time had passed and allowed me to have some new perspective on the stuff that had already happened.
And what's it feel like? It's just out recently. And as a writer of books, you know, I don't want to presume, but someone once compared it to giving birth. And so I've had I've experienced some kind version of that pain. What's it like to get this off your chest and get it on the page in such a really well executed way?
Well, now that I've given birth to an actual child, it's not like giving birth. Like, you can have your book, baby. Back together. It's weird. It feels like sort of high key of a lot of feelings of like, you know, the exposure. I think this kind of book in particular, where I was like, you know, here are all the sort of most private, shameful things that we were trained by culture not to talk about. Here they are. You know, anyone with 1795 can know my deepest, darkest shames. So like, you know, there's for sure a discomfort in that. And then it's totally grandiose to be like, everyone knows, do you know what I mean? And then also it just feels like such a relief because I've been doing this work for so long and, you know, I'm sure you understand this, like you make this stuff alone in private, you know, I had support, but like also the writer's task is a solitary task, you know? And then all of a sudden it becomes, you know, sort of a community entity and that feels good. And, you know, being able to have these conversations and, let the work live in the world separate from me feels very gratifying for sure.
I want to talk about, be a little writerly here. I want to talk about one of my favorite things about your writing. And I have two examples of it, but for listeners, there's so many in the book. Your lists, the lists that you make are so good. So I just want to read the first one that jumped out at me.
I feel like I know which one it is.
You're talking about addictions.
Yeah.
And you said, the honeymoon phase of any addictive behavior is such a swirl of pleasurable brain chemicals and renewed vigor for life that it is, for me, often impossible to turn away from. I've had it with so damn many things. I know it by heart, that new relationship energy of a fresh compulsion. So here we go, listeners. Bourbon, heroin, razor blades, credit cards, dangerous sex, face punching, cash, whiskey, bondage, check fraud, vodka, shoplifting, ketamine, methadone, red wine, cigarettes, work, nicotine gum, croissant binges, wintergreen skull. Then there was a period I thought it was over, but it wasn't over. Turning tricks, stealing cash, smoking weed, throwing up, watching porn, eating, starving, trespassing, beating men up. So I just like to say, for starters, it's nice to see that you are still here after compiling a list like that. There's times that I thought I had a self-destructive, thought I was sort of a standout in the self-destructive category. Reading those two sentences, I was like, I didn't even get started. And here's it. Here was my second favorite one. You were talking to the doctor about some hip pain, and the doctor asked you what you'd been doing to try to address the riddle of the pain. And you said, 5 years of orthopedic specialists, physical therapy, lacrosse balls, stretching, not stretching, strength training, running hills, not running hills, hydrotherapy, massage, acupuncture, dry needling, Bikram yoga, regular yoga, Tiger Balm, lidocaine, aspirin, ibuprofen, acetaminophen. And there's so many more of these. And again, there's no question here either. Just as another writer, I was like, I love this thing she does. And you keep doing it. And then suddenly I'm in the middle of another one. I'm like, oh, it's another list. Where'd that come from? Did you figure that? Do you have an inspiration as a writer, or is this something that came to you in the process?
I mean, I always love a list, and I feel like it's very representative of the way that I think, where I often feel like there's an accumulation of thoughts that is like faster and more urgent than I can write. And so they just pull up sometimes. But there's something I find very satisfying about them when, and also just, you know, on a formal level, I love a little thing nestled inside a thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. 100%.
Where do you stand today on taking care of your body? Because you went through, like, you treated it pretty harshly for quite a while. And are you a little more gentle these days? Has motherhood changed everything for you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm definitely a lot more gentle. And it's hard to say, to parse out why, because I became chronically ill, which the book sort of gets into a little bit, but you know, there's a lot more to that story since the end of the book, around the same time that I got pregnant with my child. So it's like, I have to take care of myself differently or I'm laid out. And then also I have this little person who I want to be well enough to take care of. And then also, like, I don't want to model that list for her as a way of being, do you know what I mean? But it was when I was pregnant that I was first able to, I understood what people meant when they were like, listen to your body. And I always was like, no, you cannot listen to this body. but you know, it was like, I would be tired and I would be like, oh, like we rest now. And you know, like hungry, we eat. And, you know, I think for a long time, I had learned to live with this kind of like compulsive nature that I had by creating systems of order for myself. And some of those were, you make a commitment to yourself and that is the infrastructure of your life. So like, you know, does it matter if you run 5 miles today in like a grander sense? No, but it, like, if I say I will, and then I don't, like that is the beginning of the deterioration of everything. Which is a very, you know, scarcity fear-based way to live, but it was also a lot better than the way I lived before. But so during my pregnancy was the first time I would negotiate those deals with myself. Maybe you don't have to run the miles today. Like maybe you can just rest, and you know, nothing terrible happened. And then it sort of opened up just a little more flexibility into how to be.
Was there, do you think there was one period of time where things sort of like that you went from sort of not loving yourself to like opening up to that a little, like my mom always said that, the way your world and your life is on the outside is the way you're treating yourself on the inside. So if you're getting it out in the world, you're doing it to yourself first. And, it seemed to me you had an incident in the book where you're holding a wounded piglet and you sort of have this rush of love for it and this comforting sort of thing that happens. And it seemed to me, I don't know if this is true, but it seemed to me that was sort of pivotal, that you started on a different path after that. Was there one specific thing that you know that changed in you that you remember started you on this path to kind of loving yourself a bit more?
I mean, I don't know like what was the chicken and what was the egg, but you know, leaving the space of a relationship where someone was just horrible to me on a daily basis for like decades on end was like, there wasn't room for that before that. There's no way, I don't think, like to my own experience, to like, that's not a loving thing to do to yourself, to stay in a space like that. And you know, though it was not my choice to leave that relationship, like becoming freed from it, gave me some room to, you know, I think build a relationship with myself, outside of the sort of vacuum of that chaos. But then, you know, having my kid, it's such a cliche, but it, like, for a reason, I really, something did shift, you know, and I definitely, and also, you know, I think having a partner who is, you know, like, warm and loving and not harmful, like, that didn't build the self-love for me, but it was definitely related because I wouldn't have been interested.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You had to be open somewhere to even let him in, right? That he's the reflection of you sort of loving you.
Sure.
And it gives you the external manifestation of it.
He sounds a little like a perfect man, which is a a gentle mixed martial arts specialist. It's like, what else do you want if you're a woman? You got right. He can. Yeah. Anyway, there's couple of things. You just mentioned the thing about running in my book, Tickled. One of the things I talk about is suddenly snapping out of a career as a business writer and realizing, oh my God, quantifying our lives is the source of so much of our social and individual distress, right? And you have this great sentence where you said, I didn't yet understand that how fast you can travel over 10 miles of this earth can determine whether you believe in yourself that day or not. And, you know, so I argued it's quantification, but you could go more general and just say measuring ourselves by external measures of some sort. But the easiest of those tends to be to count something, right? Where are you on that now? So you're released from running. Do you count your life still?
It is something that I feel like I am, like, moving slowly away from, but sort of similar to, like, what I had just said about the infrastructure for life. Like, I sort of built a whole way of living around that, because before I was in some other state of extreme presence that was like, I was just in the moment, you know, but, like, in a horrible way. I had to, like, I don't know, like, I would graft something onto that experience, sort of get a purchase on. And now, you know, I'm like less interested in that, but it's very reflexive, and it's a way, to just feel like there are some reference points for, you know, how I'm doing. Right. But yeah, for sure. Like, you know, I mean, I am not the athlete I once was, but I still, like, when I go work out, like, I count my reps, I count my sets, I keep track of how much I lifted each day as if I'm preparing for some competition. Right. Never going to happen. Like, I'm in my yard. and sometimes it does strike me as, like, you know, a little disordered.
Mm. I think our entire society. It's sort of the platform that we operate on, is like everything's quantified these days and measured. And
well, to that point, my argument I make in Tickled is, it's because we believe in time, which leads us to believe in the idea of progress, which leads us to want to measure progress. And that takes you off of the fact that there is only now, right? So how are you doing is not now divided by yesterday, right? I'm 10% more than yesterday. It's how are you feeling right now? On which note is a great segue. There's so many great sentences in this book, listeners. Margot used to work as a professional dominatrix, but also recounts some self-destructive relationships that had consensual violence in them. And I mean, it's, you write these sentences where they provoke a laugh, but it's kind of a shocked laugh that I'm laughing at a mm-hmm. sentence like this. And here's one of them. Violence excites me, and I've never experienced a violence more intimate than a punch in the face. And It's like, I've never been there, but your capacity with words has gotten across so much of an experience that to rest of us is just imaginary, right? You can see it in a movie. But I want to just to congratulate you again. The way that you are able to communicate, you know, a fairly traumatic and exciting is the wrong word, but eventful life. It's just astounding. It's astounding.
There was one thing I really liked. Duff and I talk about this a lot. Like, it's an Eastern philosophy. They talk about how you're not the doer. You're not the one that's sort of in charge of everything that's happening. And I think, Duff, this tied into one of your favorite lines, which I'm going to go ahead and read because it ties in with the one I liked. I can't help what I like, I told her. That turned out not to be true, but I didn't know so at the time. And the part I really liked followed that. It says, what feels preordained might in fact be the result of a series of actions and reactions at once too vast and too minute to identify. And it's like you've articulated beautifully this idea and concept that this world is happening. All of these intersecting things are just kind of, they're all happening at the same time. And like we think we have a lot of control, but we don't necessarily, right? Like we have a very small little bit of agency. Like Duff said, like you're just a gorgeous writer. And you articulate it so well.
We're not asking her any questions. We're just listing our favorite lines.
Just like here. Fans, yeah.
So, listeners, Margo worked as a iron worker as part of the union in both New York City and Hawaii. And she talks about... having like burning hot stuff go down the collar of your shirt and inside your body while you're up on a, you know, hundreds of feet up. What's the scariest moment you ever had on a building way up high?
Well, you know, what is so messed up is like the scariest moments I had doing that work were like interpersonal dynamics with other people where I was afraid I was about to be embarrassed. And I was afraid that people would see me, the men would see me as, you know, like weak or female or see me in any way. That was when I felt like the feel of fear in my body. I also had many times when I was like, you know, up a beam in my head thinking about something else. Like, this is not work that you're supposed to be doing if you're all fucked up in your mind. You know what I mean? And, you know, you just like one misstep and it's a real serious situation. I think probably the most scared I've been in like the way that makes sense is actually dropping stuff. Cause you're so high up, you can like really you can kill somebody if you drop a fair, like a bolt, like that's it. And I was, when I moved to Honolulu, I hadn't worked in a while. And I talk about this in the book, but there's like a whole system, like it's a union. So you don't like get hired on personality. You have to like go through a list, which is good. But so you get whatever random job comes up on the list. And they were like, hey, do you know how to build a crane? And I was like, sure. And you know, they get erected like a director set. Like it's like, if you ever see the big yellow tower cranes, it's like these giant pieces that get stacked by another crane, one on top of the other. And you have to like, the crew hangs out at the top and like receives it. There's a lot of like bolting and stuff. And you have to climb up the middle of it. There's like these little weird stairs, but it's mostly just clambering up. And the tools are really heavy because, you know, it's huge. And I'm not like the least clumsy person in the world. And like these guys thinking, you know, having me show up instead of like the dude that they were waiting for. And I did, I dropped a bolt. I wasn't super high up, but but you know, if somebody had been right under me, it would have done something terrible to them. And that was, I think it was a moment where I realized like the potential to cause harm, you know, and like that I needed to get out of my head if I was going to, you know, be there in a way that was ethical and safe.
Okay. I got to switching gears here. This is a real question. One of the things that also hit me in the writing of Tickled, and it's a Vedantic concept, which is our Western sort of scientific notions of causality are woefully naive, right? We think we can get to the source and the cause of things. I'm of the opinion these days that everything is the cause of everything, right? So when we try to tease it apart, we're making artificial distinctions. And yet you have this great passage that I want to read, and then I want to ask you about it. There's an idea that there is freedom in plumbing the depths of the psyche and locating the origins of troublesome behavior. In service to this idea, I have spent many thousands of dollars and hours on therapy, sat in the uncomfortable chairs of 12-step programs, and read the books of countless self-help gurus with equal parts hope and resignation. In this seeking, I found few answers, none specific enough to quell my curiosity or solve my problems. Along the way, I lost the conviction that uncovering the whys of my ways was a worthwhile enterprise. So it sounds to me that you're in the same place, which is trying to construct a narrative of what got you to where you are right now is less important than focusing on what is happening to you right now. Did I get the evolution right?
For sure. Yeah. And just like the fundamental bewilderment of letting go of that previous way of trying to figure it out.
Right. Because to me, that the biggest shift for me in quarantine was a sudden realization that everything was okay. Right. Now, the world was going crazy and people were dying. Right. Not taken away from that. But from where I was sitting, I was fine. And I, for the first time in my life, I was like, oh, my God, not only is it fine, this is a perfect existence. Right. Everything that has led to this moment, and it holds together. It doesn't disintegrate. Mm-hmm. You flirted with the kind of disintegration that I never have, but like, do you have a sense of the innate perfection of your existence now that you might not have had before?
Like yes and no. I think for me, that is not a state that I've moved into. It's more glimpses and moments, right? And with my kid is where it mostly is, where there is something about a small child and they, you know, their ability to be present, they don't know any other way, do you know? Mm-hmm. And it is infectious. And, you know, I spend a lot of one-on-one time with her. So like she draws me into her world. And it's good there, you know, but I can't really stay in it all the time. Mm.
Joey, how can she stay in it all the time?
I think she's on the right track. You know, it's like, it's a sort of that vulnerability and that willing to be open. And like, and I mean, your entire book is that, right? It's like you've laid everything out. And I think someone said once, when you have a kid, it's like letting your heart roam around outside your body. So I don't know if like you can allow yourself to be more vulnerable than that, but it's like anything else. It's not something, it's a practice, you know, you just do it when you remember.
I also think one of the most beautiful things in your book is that it's not, when we write about ourselves, and having done this myself, it was the very first time where I was like, I had a sense of certainty that I knew what I was talking about, right? Because, you know, not writing about events that took place at places that I wasn't at before I was even born, trying to write about those if I know what I'm saying. When I started writing about myself, it's like, now this topic is, I am the expert here. But you have a great capacity, and it shows up regularly, for saying, on with regard to this particular question, I don't know. I don't know why I did that. I don't know why I am or was the way I was, or am the way I am. And so it's got this great refreshing, like there's the certainty, or not certainties, but the clarity of self-awareness, mixed with the humility that you don't have all the explanations, even for your own life. And that's what makes it such a great read, because you can you can believe that you're a real person. Right?
It is. It's so very great. Like, it's, I related to so much of it, just as like, again, when you're talking about your body during pregnancy. And, you know, I think there's a reckoning at some point that women go through with your body, where, you know, it's been your filter for most of your life. And then all of a sudden it changes, whether it's from pregnancy or age, but you go through it. And it's like, there's so much that I could relate to all along the way. It's very human and sweet and beautiful. I'm so proud of you.
So you had a line that Joey and I were talking about not long before we got on here, where, you know, men and their treatment of women, you in particular or specifically, but also general, where you said you have a problem with men as an institution, but there are individual men that you have great affection and love for. Where are you on that now?
Oh, still there. You know, I mean, I have really, my dad is like wonderful and my partner is wonderful and like a wonderful father. And just like, you know, when I think about what I want, like a model of a man to be for our kids, like, I'm like, it's that, you know? And I have other like wonderful male friends. And then yet also, like, when there's a dude in the coffee line, I just often, I'm like, you know? And I think it's because I've spent so many years of my life really receiving a lot of men and feeling sort of like a liver for the behavior of men in a way that has closed me off to offering the benefit of the doubt in some ways, which is, I don't think, like, great for me as a person. But I think I also spent enough time being like, I am here to entertain and please men, that like this of being like, I just like, don't even engage with me, actually in some ways feels like a move towards,
you're netting out to zero.
Yeah. But I'm careful with my kid, you know, like I don't want to like imprint like cultural resentments into her. Do you know what I mean? So like I try to be careful with my language and with the vibe I give off, you know.
It's interesting because with the a lot of the story is highly sexualized and also the Venn diagram of violence as well. But it doesn't, I didn't really feel that you had a, that it was too sting as a male. I didn't feel that you were attacking me.
That's good. Yeah. I don't want it to feel like, it's not an anti-man book at all.
No.
And you know, were I not, like, I also clearly love men in a lot of ways, which is like what drew me into a lot of these spaces. Like, on some level, I just want to like be one. So,
you know, it's just like, it's a few bad apples, you know, spoiled a bunch. And it's like every, I think every woman, especially living in New York, it's like everyone has had been touched inappropriately at some point. And like, and so it's easy to put up, you know, you have a wall against everyone. And then I think there's, you know, it's the walking the line between safety and openness, right? And so that's always, it's a delicate balance. And I think it's one that every woman will be able to relate to.
The moment I realized that Margot might be a little more man than me was she's talking about digging with a shovel that had never been sharpened. And I was like, what? You're supposed to sharpen shovels? All right. There's another thing in here where we both wrote memoirs. They're hardly similar, but in some of our thoughts about our culture, we echo each other. This is one of my favorite sentences in the book. She's talking about why she ran ahead of like an obsessive running and marathoning thing for a while. And you said, when I ran, I wanted freedom from the relentless decision tree of contemporary American life. Perfect. Just a perfect sentence. So thank you for that. But the other thing is, I make a point in Tickled where I say, we are, our obsession with quantification has led us to believe that there are insights in the statistics of the many, right? Where we try to sort ourselves six ways from Sunday. And you said here, you're talking about, you know, why we do certain things we do. And you said the meanings to be made by examining proclivities, yours, mine, anyone's, are too idiosyncratic to conform to valuation and categorization, and that they are as prone to any, as prone as anything to shifting and changing over time. I think you were making the exact same point I was making, that is that when it comes to matters of human that have a real human dimension, we can't average ourselves, right? Is that what you, is that what you're getting at there?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, this idea that of the arrogance of thinking that you can understand, you know what I mean? And I've had so many moments myself where I'm like, no, I understand. Like, sort of more absurd than the next. And they're all circling this unwillingness to just say that it's not understandable, do you know?
Right. Or, you know, back to the earlier point, it is what it is, right? As opposed to it's not explainable, right? We understand, you know, an intuitive level who we are, but to explain ourselves, it's like I think one of the things our culture does now, which is to its detriment, is we're trying to explaining ourselves to each other all the time, instead of just doing what we're doing. I made the point about in Tickled, I said we've split into two types. There are specialists who know how to do things, and there are experts who know how to talk about things. And if you could basically go through and we're split down the middle. There's doers and there's talkers. And we get overrun with the experts whenever a crisis or a thing happens, because they come in armed with all their statistics and they're telling us why this is happening. And I think we should listen less to them. I think we should listen more to books like Brutalities, A Love Story. Listeners, this is an amazing, amazing, amazing book. It's a page turner. It's alternatingly terrifying and also like so heartwarming. The insights about herself, but also just human fallibility, every single page. We wish you, someone on the cover of it wrote, a perfect book. We couldn't agree more. Margot, it's been great to have you. Good
Thank
luck
you so
with it.
Much. Thank you for all the kind words and for the space and the conversation. This was awesome.
We'll have you back when your next one's out.
Yeah. So, thank you.
She's great, right?
Yeah, she is.
Readers or listeners, we didn't really get into it, but this is a sort of a harrowing memoir of time spent as a professional dominatrix, a sex worker, in violent relationships,
a metal worker,
as a metal worker, getting involved in mixed martial arts with her current partner, the kind of mistreatment of the body that we inflict on it under the guise of treating it well.
Mm-hmm.
For one, the story is just astounding. You don't know many stories like this, but also the sort of detachment and insights that she's been able to look back from a remove are just remarkable. It's unbelievable.
It's really easy just to slip into it. Like it reads, it almost like you're reading fiction. It's like, it's super easy to read and just, I don't know. I loved everything about it.
No, she's a great writer. She's a great, great, great writer. Congratulations, Margo. Okay. So I've got one for you here that may be the archetypal. I've got one for you. I can't believe I didn't know. Matt, this would be Matt approved. Matt would give it all the stars, not just five, all of them. You know, listeners, no, it's etymology, but also just words within words and things hidden within words. Margo was talking about how she loves sort of things nested inside of other things, you know, little Easter eggs in the book. So I've got one for you, is that in language. So why do you think we call it the alphabet?
It's because it's the first thing. It's primary. I don't know.
Yes and no. It's alpha and beta, which are the first two letters in the Greek alphabet. So we're literally, we call the alphabet because it's as if you've started listing the alphabet.
So calling it your ABCs is completely appropriate. It's not like it's not a slang term. That's really what it is.
It's the same thing. The Greek is just a little more sophisticated. Alphabet. It's what it is hidden within the word itself. Never even occurred to me.
So if you're sophisticated, you call it the alphabet.
Yes, exactly. Right? We're all sophisticated.
So I have a little Hafez for you, if you'd like.
Please.
I can give a little read. It seemed appropriate because we were talking about... everything that we do in our life really is a desire to connect, right? Everything, like it's, we go about it in some crazy, weird ways, but really ultimately everything is because we're looking for that connection. And Betty always told me that you can only really get that inside. You can't get it outside. So Hafez sort of fits into that. So it's called Admit Something. And this is by Daniel Ladinsky because I love his translations. Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, love me. Of course, you do not say this out loud. Otherwise, someone would call the cops. Still, though, think about this. This great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye that is always saying with that sweet moon language what every other eye in this world is dying to hear? I love him so much.
Nice one. I can't follow that. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you in a week.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to How to Tickle Yourself with your host, Duff McDonald, and me, Joey of Rockledge. You can help us by liking, subscribing, and sharing this podcast with others. You can talk to us and see what else is happening on Instagram and Facebook at How to Tickle Yourself. This program was recorded in Studio B of the historic Rockledge Recording Studio. Right here, right now, our original 16-part theme music was written and recorded by the legendary Paul Reddick and Kyle Ferguson of the Sidemen, with Steve Mariner on bass and drums and in the mixing room. This podcast is produced and distributed by Storic Media. Our editor is Oscar Desiderio. Our producers are Kristen Verbitsky and Chuck Labella. For more information, visit storicmedia.com. That's storicmedia.com. My love.